Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Jeff Sachs here, Mishkan Tzipora, Web Yeshiva, Masechet Ta'anit. We are on Daf Kaf Amud Aleph 20A at the bottom of the beginning, towards the beginning of the thick lines, or the middle-sized lines in the middle. We have a continuation of what we were discussing in the previous apologies. We took off last week because of Hanukkah. Hope everyone had a good Hanukkah. But when we last met 2 weeks ago, we had learned the story about Nachdimon Ben Gurion, who had this kind of a miraculous interaction with the Roman officials, and this thing about paying back a debt and whether or not he missed the deadline or he didn't miss the deadline, and the sun standing still or the sun peeking out or coming out or piercing out through the clouds after everyone had thought the sun had set and that he had missed the... Yehudi, I'm muting you for the time being because we're getting some feedback from your microphone. You can unmute at need. There you go. And whether or not this was a miracle or whether it was just, you know, as was the case, you know, as reported elsewhere, the Gemara in Brachot famously has a case of, you know, the sun sets on a Friday, people go to shul, they daven, and they leave shul and discover the sun is still shining because the sun hadn't set. It would have been a cloudy day. It would have been overcast and they misunderstood. So this idea of the sun coming out after it had already set or making it look like it was dark or whatever exactly is going on here, the Gemara says Tanura Banan Shlosha Nikdamu Lahem Chama Ba'avuran. There were three figures for whom such a miracle, a meteorological miracle or occurrence took place. Moshe V'Yehoshua V'Nachdimon Ben Gurion.
It's kind of interesting, by the way. I just noticed that in the end of the Gemara we read last week, or 2 weeks ago, it said, why was he called Nachdimon Shenik Dara Chama Bavuro? But here, the Brita says
it's Nikdama.
Like Nachdimon. It's actually same name. It's strange that they use the Nikdara instead of Nikdama.
Is there another Nusach of the Gemara there that doesn't say Nikdara, but Nikdama?
I don't have one, but it's possible.
You can understand that a Resh and a Mem can easily be...
Yes. In your Gemara it says it. And it says...
Right.
In the Haggadah Bach.
Oh, the Haggadah Bach, here. Okay. So that solves the mystery. You can understand why how a mem and a resh can get confused, even though they're not next to each other on the keyboard. So who were these three for whom such a miracle was performed? Nachdimon Ben Gurion, Abishlam and Nachdimon Ben Gurion, Gemara. We just taught the story of Nachdimon Ben Gurion. That's the source. Yehoshua Nami, Kradichtiv, and Joshua, of course, famously is described in the pasuk in the book on his name. Vido, Mashemesh, Viareach, Hamad, right? Shemesh begivon dom, Viareach beemekai alone. We know that story, which is a little bit different. That story is not exactly that the sun sets and then it comes out. There, the sun is standing still. But they are all miracles about somehow something going on with the passage of the sun across the heavenly sphere. Ela Moshe Minalan. What is the source that Moshe experienced some kind of miracle with the sun? So there are a few different ways to... There are three different explanations to say that even though nowhere in the Pshuto Shel Mikra, nevertheless... Moshe Rabbeinu had such a miracle. So Omar Rabbi Elazar, Atya Achel. There's a hekesh between the word Achel in two different psukim. K'tiv hacha Achel teit pachdecha. In the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, in the war against Sichon, it uses the word Achel, that Hashem says, I will I will start. I will begin to give my fear. Right, the fear of God will be upon the foreign nations that are waging war on Israel, and I, God, will achel. I will initiate the pachad that people will have, the chet, the pachad that will be given unto those nations. Uchtivhatam, and it's written in the book of Joshua, achel gadlecha. So just like in that, I will begin. Hashem says, I will begin to. Wait, what's the pasuk? Hold on, I should have it on the screen. It's Yehoshua, Perek, Gimel, Pasuk, Zion. Slicha. Vayomer Hashem el Yehoshua, Hayom hazeh achel gadlecha be'enei kol Yisrael. Right? When Yehoshua enters into his position as the successor to Moshe, Hashem tells him, I will begin to make you look great in the eyes of the nation. Asher yadun ki kaasher hayiti im Moshe eimach, and they will know that just as I shared this special relationship and you had a special status in Moshe had a special status in my eyes, so too you, Yehoshua. So the hekesh between the status of Moshe and the status of Yehoshua kind of flows in both directions. Yehoshua was the agent or was the recipient of a particular miracle regarding the motion of the sun. So too, we know because of this hekesh, this connection of the verses, that Moshe Rabbeinu was similarly blessed with such a miracle. Rabbi Yochanan gives a third explanation for how we see between the lines that Moshe had a miracle. And what was that miracle? Atia migufe dekra. You don't need a special hekesh. You don't need to connect in coded manner different psukim to read between the lines. It's an explicit verse. But then what's the explicit verse? It's not so explicit. Asher yishmuun shimecha viragzu vechalu mipanecha. There in Dvarim Perek Beis, in the war against Sichon, Hashem tells Moshe that when that other nation hears about you, when they get an earful about you, and they start to tremble, and they'll be all agitated because of you, they'll be scared. Eimatai ragzu v'chalu mipanecha. When are all those people going to be trembling and shaking and quaking in their boots? Bisha shenikdama lo chamal Moshe. When that miracle was performed for Moshe, that during the war the sun shines through and saves the day for Moshe. It's a little strange, and Rabbi Yochanan can't be taken at his word because he says, "Well, you don't need a hekesh because it's an explicit pasuk," but the explicit pasuk is not explicit that this is what happened in the way that Shemesh Begivon Dom is explicit about Yehoshua. So Yehudi today sent me a very interesting email, which I'm going to share with you now, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to him to share his thoughts on this, because I think he's really discovered something quite interesting. Do you want me to? Do I need to set it up in any other way, Yehudi, or you'll lead us through this idea of yours?
Well, I'm going to read it, but by all means, you should have the two kids.
Well, here they are on the screen. Is the email that you sent me?
Okay, fine. Yeah. So, I think when you get we've discussed this before. When it probably starts getting interpretations to the Sukkim from Tanakh that seem absolutely off the wall, then the question is not so much, you know.
Let's not say off the wall, let's say a little far fetched.
Very far fetched. Okay, fine. Far fetched is fine. Okay. Either way, the question is, what's the agenda when you come up with something like that? In other words, when you study Midrashim, first thing you want to find out is, like, remember, I think you quoted Nechama was saying about Rashi Makashelo. So what the Bible, I think you also have to say Makashelo, and that they would come up with something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying the reason they would come up with this is because they can't deal with a situation where a secondary prophet like Yahushua goes and produces a miracle that's greater than anything Moshe produced, or at least something Moshe never did. So they tried to give Moshe things that basically really happened to other prophets. So the first example is that famous story about how Pharaoh wants to find out whether this little kid is really a threat to him. So he puts in front of him two plates, one with the hot coals and one with the gold and silver. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes for the gold and silver. The angel comes and pushes his hand over, touches the hot coals, then touches his mouth. And that's how he gets to be Kavod Pe V'Chaval Lashon. But in my eyes, a good reason for that midrash is the fact that this also gives Moshe a direct touch experience to start off his nevuah, such as had by Yeshayo, Yirmiyo, and Yechezkel. The psukim are Vayaf Elei Achad Men Hasrafim Uviyado Ritzpa V'Mel Kachem Otach Meah Hamizbech V'Agal Pi V'Yomer Hinei Nagaz Zal Sfatecha V'Sar Bonecha V'Chat Hatchat Chupar. So it's clear that midrash is really picking off the story of Yeshayo. And then we have the same thing happening to Yirmiyo. Vayishlach Hashem et Yado V'Agal Pi V'Yomer Hashem Elai Hinei Natati Dvarei B'Tzicha. And Father Yecheskel has to use his mouth for an oral, O-R-A-L, experience. V'Yirev Hinei Yad Shlu Chalap V'Nai. And there's a Megillat Sefer that says, Kinim V'Hegel V'Hi. And Hashem commanded them, Echol Ta Megillah Azot. And he eats it, and then it says about the Hebrew feature, the Vash Levantok. So, in other words, the rabbis had a problem with a situation where the initiation experience for the three major prophets was a direct thing that actually touched their mouth, and that does not happen to Moshe. And a second Agadah that I think reflects a different prophet is all these stories about how Moshe was so disappointed when Yehoshua was chosen to succeed him, because he really hoped that Gershom or Eliezer would succeed him. And the fact is that this is part of the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't express even a whiff of disappointment. And in fact, the prophet who did that was Shmuel. And Shmuel proceeds to take his worthless sons and make them shoftim Yisrael.
Could you please be quiet?
And that's the direct thing that leads to the Israelites asking for a melucha. But four chapters later, when Shmuel is giving what appears to be his retirement speech, he still hasn't been prepared to accept this. Okay? So in his case, it's very clear that, he was bitterly disappointed that his sons were not worthy. And we're going to have to say that about Moshe too. In other words, Moshe's Adon HaNeviim. It's almost like, what's the one about Maaseh Avot Siman LeBanim? Sometimes that works backwards. Okay? That's, in other words, that's all I'm saying is when you look at a midrash that really seems to be distorting the Tanakh, you have to find out why would they do that to the Tanakh? In other words, after all, the Tanakh is supposed to be sacred text. Why in heaven's name are we going to turn it upside down like that? So there's got to be a reason. So I'm suggesting a possible reason for this idea that Moses makes the sun stand still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. I thought that was an interesting insight. I mean, I might have phrased it slightly different, but the sources that you marshal really do point to this idea that in order to maintain the uniqueness of Moshe's nevuah, his role, his leadership, etc. So any great act that comes after is already presaged in, even if it has to be midrashically imagined between the lines, in Moshe's life.
I wonder why, if you're talking about playing with the sun, couldn't they have quoted the Makach Choshech? that wouldn't have been an easier thing than talking about Tikhon Vogue, which had no real connection to anything. I mean, Yoshua needed the sun to go longer because of the necessity of the battle, but with Makar Choshech, that would have been something you could say that, you know, the sun stopped if you're talking about that. Makar Choshech
doesn't involve Moshe doing anything. Other Makot involve Moshe waving his rod or throwing something into the air. Makar Choshech just happens. Remember the bit with Adach, Jitzach, Abiyachav? Now, that there's each one of the Makai, Kasudo explains in his Perush of Sefer Shemot, that's not just a mnemonic. It also shows that in the series, Makai 1, 4, and 7 have something in common. Makai 2, 5, and 8 have something in common. Makai 3, 6, and 9 have something in common in the sense that neither Moshe or Aaron does anything. They just happen.
I think it's also the case that Choshech is a mirror image. In other words, Choshech, in the other cases, the sun comes out when it's needed. Choshech is the opposite. So it doesn't necessarily fit into these templates. So I imagine if we spent more time thinking about this, Yehudi, we could come up with other examples and find other midrashic readings of future events read back into...
because I just wanted to get it started. Seems to me an outstanding example. And the thing is, one of the things Masechet Tanya is famous for is its agadot. Okay?
Yes, as we're about to encounter.
We're about to read some of the best ones and the most famous ones of all. Right. So if an agadah is just a story about, what you call rabbinic tale, it doesn't involve a verse, that's one thing. But if what's going on is playing around with a verse, then you got to figure out what are they up to with this verse? What are they trying to do? That's all.
Right. The Gemara now goes back to the Mishnah, but I pointed out to you that the way this perek is set up, all of the Mishnayot and the perek are front-loaded. So you have to keep jumping back. So I just, for convenience, cut and paste it here. The third Mishnah of the perek says, V'chein ir shelo yardu aleheg shamim. A city which where there's no rain, but the Mishnah says, "Dichtiv," quoting a pasuk in Amos, "Vehimtarti al ir achat val ir achat," meaning a different city, lo amtir. Lo amtir, chelka achat timater, vechelka asher lo. Tamtir aleha tivash. The Mishnah abbreviates the pasuk, but the whole pasuk in context says that Hashem, through the Navi Amos, warns the Jewish people that he's going to withhold rain, and this will interrupt the harvest. There'll be 3 months. 3 months before the harvest, meaning at the time when we still need the rain, and it'll rain in one city, but on the other city it won't rain. One field, one chelka, will get rain, and one field, one chelka, will not get rain, and one field, the field where there's no rain will wither, will dry up, will not survive. So the Mishnah goes on and says, "Ota ir mitane umitraet." The city that got the rain, the city that didn't get the rain, they should fast and they should call out in tefillah. V'chol svivoteha mitanot v'lo matriot. And the surrounding areas should also fast, although they do not need to have this calling out in tefillah. Rabbi Akiva omer matriot v'lo mitanot. Rabbi Akiva switches it and says they do call out in prayer, but the surrounding areas do not fast. So go back to the Gemara on Daf Kof Amud Aleph. Omar of Yehuda, Omar of Vishtehen Liklala. But both cities, the one that gets the rain and the one that doesn't get the rain, are cursed. Right? Why? Because one will get the drought, and the other one will maybe get too much rain. Right? In other words, he says that it makes it seem like one is getting a bracha and one is getting a klala, or one is neutral and one isn't. But no, the whole place, these two cities of Amos, right, one gets rain and one doesn't get rain. The one that doesn't get rain has a drought. But the one that gets rain, it gets too much rain. There's a tropical storm comes and destroys things. So then the Gemara goes off on this kind of tangent where it shows that, because the Pshuto Shel Mikra in Amos makes it seem the city that gets the rain is getting a bracha, and the city that doesn't get the rain is getting the klala. So the Gemara goes on to say that not everything that's a bracha is a bracha, not everything that's a klala is a klala. And it brings a variety of psukim, and it reads them against the grain, right? In other words, if Yehudi over here has a question about how the Chazal read the Tanakh, he's going to have real problems with these readings. Haitayu shalaim l'nida v'nehem. A pasuk in Echa, that Yerushalayim compared to the other cities, that Yerushalayim is like a nida, is like a menstruating woman, which at least according to the Pshuto Shel Mikra, with no offense to menstruating women, but it's a sign of it's a metaphor for tum'ah, for impurity, and according to the simple reading, it's meant to sound like it's not so good for Yerushalayim. So the Gemara says, Omar of Yehuda Omar Rav, Livracha. No. To call Yerushalayim the Nida compared to the other cities is actually a bracha. Kanida, just like a woman who is menstruant. Ma Nida Yeshla Heter, Af Yerushalayim Yeshla Heter, Yeshla Takana. So you know what's the thing about being impure? There's always a way to become pure. There's always a way to make tikkun. There's always a way out of it. It's not a permanent state. It's true. There's no way to deny that Echa is describing Yerushalayim at its lowest. But to describe it as a nida says, okay, we can deal with that. We can find a way to purify it, to perfect it, to repair it. So to call Yerushalayim a nida has hidden within it a bracha, because the path to purification is right there in plain sight.
I wonder if this is maybe somewhat of an anti-Christian polemic. I know that the Christians would often take psukim. They were talking about how the Jews were punished, and it would be, right, they took it over. So if the rabbis could say these, you think things are terrible for the Jews? No, it's actually not bad. Here it can get better. We can fix. God didn't give up on us, and so on. Then there's a reason to be able to take the mikra mide pshuto in order to give it a more positive spin during the time when there was those need for the polemics.
Right. Perhaps in the next pasuk, haitaka almana, even more, because that was used quite a bit in Jewish Christian polemics, to say that the Jewish people were the widows of God, that they had been left behind, and now Christianity, the Christian church, had replaced us. Yehuda, you're raising your hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I don't think Jewish-Christian polemics were quite as important in Iran or in eastern Iraq as they were in Eretz Israel, and in the areas that were closer to Eretz Israel. After all, Paul's going northwest, he's not going northeast. Basically, Christianity reached as far as Edessa, but the rabbis on the canals between the Tigris and the Euphrates really didn't. That wasn't one of their major. They wouldn't come up with something like this to knock off Christianity. That would be an Eretz Israel thing. Christianity wasn't that much of a deal for the people of Amorai and above that.
Okay, I hear that. So Haitaka Almana, Omar of Yehuda, Livracha. So when the first pasuk in Echa Yashva Vadad, Ha'ir Abatiyam, Haita Ke'almana, that Jerusalem is like a widow, abandoned like a widow, it's actually a bracha. Ke'almana, Rashi quotes this. This is the first Rashi in Echa, on the first pasuk in Echa. Ke'almana, Velo Almana, Mamash. Not a literal widow. Ela Ki'isha Shehalach Ba'ala LeMedinat Hayam. Vedato lachzor aleha. What was colloquially called a grass widow, meaning a woman whose husband is temporarily absent but intends to return. Jerusalem is never abandoned, although it is perhaps temporarily temporarily left isolated. That God has not divorced the Jewish people. God has not left the Jewish people a widow. But there's no doubt that they're separated. And he intends to return. Now, of course, this imagery of the Isha shehalach ba'ala l'medinat hayam v'dato lachzor leha, this refers, of course, to the situation of not a widow and not a grusha, not a divorcee, but more colloquially, an aguna. Right, an aguna, not in the, David, you and I once spoke about this, right? The way that we colloquially use aguna today is not the way that, today's agunot, the women that are called agunot today are more properly termed misuravot get. Because of the dynamics of how Jewish divorce works, that the giving of the get has to be initiated by the husband, this gives an imbalance of power in the favor of the husband. In the old days, a husband that wasn't doing his duty after a marriage had fallen apart and gave a get, so they used to come and they used to, burn his house down or whack him with a broomstick or whatever it was to convince him to do the right thing. Nowadays, we're more civilized and we don't do that. We just allow husbands to leave their wives agunot for many years in the name of being civilized. So technically speaking, the women today are not agunot. They are misuravot get. They are being denied their divorce. Aguna, in the classical halachic sense, although David, you've I think told me that it's only a folk etymology to point to the Hebrew term ogen, anchored, that these women are chained to these marriages, but it's a useful folk etymology, regardless of what it actually where the word actually comes from. And aguna is the exact opposite. The classic aguna in classic Hebrew literature is emotionally the exact opposite. Right? And in a contemporary sense, we know where the husband is. Right? He's just a no good nick, and if we can convince him to do the right thing, he would give her a get and she'd be done with him. But she hates him, she doesn't want anything to do with him. In the classical sense, the woman is literally chained in love to this husband who is absent. He goes off to sea, he goes off on some voyage or some journey. And unlike today, when we're in touch. Sometimes I talk to if I go to America, in the days when you could go to America for work, sometimes I talk to my kids more when I'm in America than when I'm home. Because when I'm home, they're not always so interested in talking to me. But when you're in America, so you're FaceTiming with them and you're talking to them and they're asking you about what you're doing and they want to see where you're staying and all those other things. And when I come back, when you come back, they know exactly what time you're going to walk in the door, right? Because Waze tells you you're going to be there at exactly such and such a time. But in the days of old, a person went off on a journey, right? How long was the journey? Well, it was as long as it would take. And at a certain point, when he didn't come home, you started to worry. But even before you came home, they started to worry the minute you left, because there was that lack of clarity about when you would return. So every moment that you were gone. Every moment that you're gone, there's this kind of da'aga, and that's what Rashi says. The woman whose husband has gone off on a trip, she's like a widow, but she's like an aguna. So Agnon, who takes his name, Agnon, from his debut story upon arriving in Eretz Yisrael called Agunot, right, is dealing with these themes. Now, he's dealing with them symbolically. For Agnon, the Aguna is the Jewish people. If you remember the well-known Midrash comparing God and the Jewish people to husband and wife, you know the idea, right? God and the Jewish people, husband and wife, and the Kofen Aleim Har Kegigit, holding the mountain above them, is the Chuppah, and the Torah itself is the Ketubah. So where's the marital home? The marital home should be in Eretz Yisrael, or it should be in the Beit HaMikdash, or in Yerushalayim. So this marriage between God and the Jewish people is one which One which is, you could use a little marital therapy, because for 2,000 years, we have not been living together as man and wife in the marital home in Eretz Yisrael or in Yerushalayim or in Beit HaMikdash, according to the unpacking of the metaphor. So when Agnon talks about Agunot, he's not talking about, certainly not the contemporary situation of Misurovot Get, but he's speaking psychically about Agunot. And even that story, that famous pen story, Agunot, which was first published in 1908 upon his arrival in Yafo, even that is not explicitly about Agunot, even in the conventional sense. It's about this kind of psychic bond and the emotional struggle of one who loves another, but they cannot be united. So in a different story called Hamitpachat, in English it's called the kerchief, Agnon takes this Gemara and this Pasuk from Eicha and the Gemara that's quoted in the Rashi, and tells a story which has an autobiographical layer, in which Bechol Shana V'Shana Haya Abba Zichrono Levracha Noseya LeYerid Lashkovitz. Every year his father would have to travel for business to go to the big trade fair in some nearby city. Shvua shenasa Abba LeYerid Domeh Haya Aleinu Keshvua Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av. And the week that father would be away on business was like the week of Tisha B'Av. It was like the 9 days. Kol Atam Yamim Lo Nira Schok Al Paneah Shel Ima V'Af HaYeladim Hayu Onsim Atzmam Min HaSchok. Right, the whole week, mother had a very stern demeanor, right, because there was this anxiety. Hold on a second. Where does it quote it? Then he goes on to say, "Liamim kishakarati b'megilat Eicha hayta kealmana." And then later, in years later, when I started learning Tanakh and I read that first pasuk in Eicha, how Yerushalayim is like a widow, who favors Rashi Zal, which is the quote from our Gemara, "Ki isha shehalach ba'ala l'medina tayam v'dato lachzor etzla niskara lefanai ima le'a shalom b'sha shehayta yoshevet b'chalon." I remembered my mother sitting by the window with a tear on her cheek, waiting in anticipation and anxiety for father to return from the journey. So that's the idea that's captured here. So Haita Ke'almana isn't such a klala, because what happens at the end? Father comes back, right? That is, to call her an almana is only referring to her emotional state, not to her marital state, not to her halachic state, right? But it's the emotional state of waiting for Yerushalayim to be reunited with her husband, with God, right? Which can be repaired, right? That's built into the destruction is the hope of Geula. Another posuk, this time a posuk in Malachi, V'gam ani natati etchem nivzim ushfeilim. Hashem says that he's going to make the Jewish people kind of downtrodden and nivzim, bazui, degraded and downtrodden. Omer Rav Yehuda, doesn't that sound like a bracha? Doesn't that sound like a klalana? Rav Yehuda says it's a bracha. De lo mokmi minan lo reshein hera velo gziripate. Right, because the Jewish people were kind of lowly in the eyes of the non-Jews, so they weren't appointed to high positions. They weren't made roshei naharei. They weren't made. Rashi explains it's like tax collectors. They were, you know, like the people that were in charge of the river. Traffic, as Yehudi just pointed out a minute ago, Yahadut Bavel sat between the two great rivers and on the banks of those rivers and their tributaries, and a lot of the trade was conducted on the waterfront. And that was a position. It was a position of high authority and also presumably some financial value to be the toll collector or the tax collector or the, you know, to be in charge of the meches. As you know from the famous play and movie On the Waterfront, these were places with a lot of corruption because money was always changing hands, and the mafia could take control and have their palms greased. So because we weren't in positions of authority and power, we didn't get into that kind of trouble. We didn't become the tax collectors or the officials or other things which always caused trouble. Later in history, those things did happen. In Poland and in Russia, this often did happen, right? Particularly, let's say in Galicia, often described again in Agnon's writings, the lands were owned by Polish noblemen, and the local Ukrainians and Ruthenians and Tatars and these other ethnic groups were the peasants, and the Jews were often made the middlemen, right? The Jews would become the tax collectors for the Polish nobility, and, you know, the Ukrainians could not easily fight against their landlords off in distant places, and even if they could, they weren't so inclined to fight against the stronger people, but they could cause a pogrom against the Jews, who were often the middlemen between the Polish nobility and the Ukrainian peasants. The Gzerot Tach V'Tat, which we spoke about not long ago, was an example of this. The Ukrainians were really rising up against, in the 17th century, they were rising up against Polish control of what they considered their own native land and territory. But along the way, it was just as easy to beat up and kill a couple 10,000 Jews and destroy, you know, a couple hundred shtetlach and synagogues and other things. But their gripe was really not against the Jews per se. It was the Jews viewed as the agents of the Polish upper class. So because we weren't in Bavel, we weren't appointed to those kinds of positions, we didn't get into any trouble. So to say that we were downtrodden and we were seen as despicable, it has a silver lining. Not every klala is a klala. Sometimes there's a hidden bracha. Another posuk in Malachim, Vehika Hashem et Yisrael kasher yanud hakane b'mayim. Hashem is going to smack us the way a reed is shaken in the water. You know, like picture, I was going to try to find a video of this, but you can imagine what like a little patch of reeds look like as the river is running past it. The reeds are being shaken and tossed around. So too, when Hashem punishes us, he's smacking us, he's whacking us, he's giving it to us, he's giving it to us really good. So Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Rav Levracha, what are you talking about? That curse that Hashem's going to give us a smack, that's also a bracha. The Omer of Shmuel bar Nachmani, Omer Rabbi Yonatan, my dichtiv, ne'emanim pitzei ohev, v'na'tarot nishikot sone. That the wounds of a friend are faithful, right? Sometimes, you know, even our friends can hurt us, right? But the kisses of the enemy are deceitful. So Tova klala shekilel achya hashiloni et Yisrael yoter mibracha shebirchan Bilam harasha. The curse of Achya hashiloni at the beginning. Achya hashiloni is a navi who lives at the time of Shlomo HaMelech. He's the one that prophesizes the pitzul hamelucha, the split, the civil war, the division of the 10 tribes from the two, the split of Yisrael in the north and Yehuda in the south. So better is the curse of Achya Shiloni than the bracha of Bilam HaRasha. And in the end, Bilam says some very nice things about us, even though that wasn't his intention, right? But the klalot of Achya were better were because hidden in those klalot are real brachot. This, it reminds me, I think Elie Wiesel has a line. I saw it recently online in the context of the nuclear talks with Iran. Elie Wiesel said something like, I think this is an exact quote, believe the threats of your enemies more than the promises of your friends. So Achya Shiloni, Kelan Bikane, when Achya Shiloni wanted to curse the Jewish people, he wasn't really cursing them, he was prophesying the bad things that would happen, but he did it through the metaphor of this reed, right? That pasuk that Hashem smacks us around the way the reeds get smacked around in the water. Omar lehem Yisrael vehika et Hashem et Yisrael kasher yanud hakane. That Hashem is going to smack Israel just the way that the reed is beaten up in the water. Ma kane ze omed bimkom mayim, v'gizo machalif, v'sharashav mirubin, v'afilu kol aruchot sheba olam ba'ut v'noshvot bo, ein mazizot oto bimkomo, ela holech uva imahem. The mama aruchot amad hakane bimkomo. So how does it work? A reed. A reed is very flexible, and it stands there in the water. And the shoots are machlif. In other words, it doesn't die, right? In other words, but the outer the husk of the reed will dry. You know, like a snake shedding its skin or something like that. I think I'm explaining this right from what I saw about reed botany today. The outer husk of the reed dries out and sheds off, and there's a new husk that grows from underneath. Meaning it survives. The reed is a survivor. V'shorashav merubin, and it has many roots that go down into the riverbank. V'afilu kol haruchot sheba olam ba'ot v'noshvot. And even all the wind of the world comes and blows it around, it doesn't uproot it from its place. Ela holechu v'amahem. The reed is flexible, right? It can move. And when the winds stop, amad hakaneh bimkomo. When the wind stops, the reed still stands. But Bilam, so to say that Hashem is going to smack you like a reed, it's not so bad. Why? Because the reed is a survivor. The reed can take it. But what happens to Bilam? What's Bilam? Bilam doesn't compare the Jewish people to a reed. He compares them to a mighty cedar tree. Aval Bilam Arasha Berchan Be'erez. In Bilam's bracha, he compares the Jewish people to a cedar, to this tall, majestic tree, Shne'emar, Arazim Alei Mayim, like a cedar on the riverbank. Ma erez ze eno omeid bimkom mayim, ve'ein gizo machalif, ve'ein sharasham rubin, afilu kol aruchot shebolam noshvot bo, ein mazizot oto mimkomo, kevan shenashva bo ruach dromit, o karto v'hofachto al panav. The erez can be fallen, can be felled. You can fall. You can chop down an erez. The wind can come and uproot the tree. Because even though it's a mighty tree, right, its roots are not as deep, and it can be turned over. Velo od elish zacha kaneli tol hemenu kumus. And the lowly, modest little reed has another virtue over the mighty cedar. Because you can pluck a little reed and you can turn it into the instrument of writing Sefer Torah, Tzfilin, Mezuzot, Navi, Ktuvim, etc. Oh, let's just finish up here. Tanu Rabbanan Leolam Yehe Adam Rach Kekane V'Al Yehe Kasheh Ke'erez. And therefore, it's always better to be flexible and soft like a reed, and not hard and inflexible like a cedar, because it helps you withstand. That's the greatness of the Jewish people, that we were flexible, that we were able to withstand galut, and we were able to withstand oppression. And you know, it's like, what's that, the zen of it all? We were able to roll, you to be able to roll with the punches, right, is a great virtue. Now the Gemara transitions into another rather well-known Agadah, which has this idea at its base, and we'll come back to that next week, starting from the bottom of Kaf Amud Aleph. Okay, so welcome back. Nice to see everybody. Nice turnout. Yehudi, thank you for your insights to this.
Thank you, Rabbi Sachs, for letting me read this.
Yes.
Two questions. Mm-hmm. One, does Rosh Chodesh mean a wind coming from the south or blowing towards the south?
I don't know. What do you think?
Sounds like from the south. From
the south. Northern winds are more strong than the southern winds are, and northern winds blow towards the south.
We know where the winds come from, but we do not know where they're going. So it's from.
All right. And
how do we know that the southern winds are not as strong? I mean, besides the famous Frank Sinatra song, the southern wind came blowing in across the sea. How do we know that northern winds are stronger than southern winds?
They are most of the parts of the world, and in general, bad things in the Tanakh come from the north.
Bad things, you know? North, yeah. Well, if you're in
the mom and not so far. I don't think he would say that if that wasn't a common experience. You follow what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Remember, Yechezkel starts with that. Ruach Sarah Baham and Atzafon.
Presumably it's not a metaphorical question. It's a meteorological question, which is the wind that's stronger. But
you're living in Israel. And the other question I wanted to know was, I read in Ma'ariv an article.
It happens that here in Efrat, it's very, very windy here in Efrat, and the strong wind comes from the north. Moving south.
Right, so that's right.
I think 2 weeks ago I told that story about the tree we had that we took care of, and no matter what we did, wind knocked it. That was a wind coming from the north.
I'll look into that. Second one, I like help also. I read in my rib a few years ago that there's more agunim in Israel than there are agunot.
What are you?
I don't know. I mean, there is such a case. In other words, now because since one of the takanot of Rabbeinu Gershom is that a husband can't divorce his wife against her will, a woman can create a situation in which the get is prevented or is delayed, etc. So there is such a... It does flow both ways, but I think
It was just now with Shuli Rand.
But, you know, the men have this heter meir rabbonim mechanism, which was just put. Yeah, there's a well-known artist, well-known actor, musician here named Shuli Rand, you know, of the Ushpizin film fame, who just got, his wife would not accept the divorce, and he just got remarried using the Heter Meir Rabbonim. But I, in terms of the statistics, I don't know. I'm not sure.
My son was a Magun.
I'm sorry to hear that.
His wife was the Masoret Get. She wouldn't accept the Get,
right,
until he threatened to sue her in the civil court.
Yeah.
It happens, but it does not get the publicity that Agunot.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You can understand. But I'd be surprised if there are more men in the situation than women, but I don't know. If you have an access to, you said you saw it in Yediot?
Ma'ariv, about 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe longer than that. But the reason I got upset was there was a woman